Welcome to Tips from the Server Room. This podcast is designed for all you systems admins, network specialists, or the guys and gals out there in the office who handles it all. Sit back, relax, grab a beverage, and enjoy Tips from the Server Room. Welcome back, my friends, once again to another episode of Tips from the Server Room. This is episode number 65 for September the 30th, 2014. I'm your host, Jack, and I will bring you all things connected, all things servers, switches, fiber, man, everything it takes to build a network and to run one. We will bring you over this podcast. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Check out all the great tech podcasts at techpodcast.com. Please check out my website if you have a chance at tipsfromtheserveroom.com, where you can comment on these shows. You can also leave me a voice message at 724-701-0550. Once again, if you missed that number, it's 724-701-0550. If you have any questions or ideas for future shows, you can definitely email those to me. And the email address you're looking for is jackstechcorner@gmail.com. And you can follow me on Twitter and as at Technoman. It's one of those great times of the week. I really enjoy sitting here and getting to talk about all things connected. You know, when you're podcasting about something that you thoroughly enjoy, it's pretty easy to wrestle together a show and to spread the word out there, the magical word of servers and all things connected. Tonight we're going to begin with a comment that I received on the website. The comment on the website. What a unique idea. If you go to tipsfromtheserveroom.com and you look for the current show, this current show, as I said, is show number 65. You can click on the comment button and you can add a comment to that actual show. And what's going to happen then is you are going to be able to, send me some of your information in. Because, folks, as I tell my interns and I tell my partners that I work with and my clients, you know, I don't have all the answers. And sometimes the answers I have may be a little skeptic to you, and you might be saying, is that true? Is that really true what Jack is telling us? I want your feedback, and I need your feedback. That's very, very important to any podcaster out there. So tonight, first thing I'm going to do is bring you a comment from the show from last week. This comment is from Jeff, and Jeff happens to be from the Podnuts Network. Now, let's go ahead and read the comment. This podcast, the podcast on licensing about knocked me off my chair. I love when I have that impact with people out there. And Jeff, I love that opening statement. Somehow I knocked you off your chair. And obviously you know what you're doing, right? You're a server guy. I appreciated your show notes. I have never heard that you need a CAL. Remember we talked about client access licenses last week. For a multifunction printer. Does this mean I need a CAL for my IP cameras, smart switches, routers, copiers? I have asked around the community and other server admins and have never heard of this before. I also asked some volume licensing sales reps and I'm waiting some answers. I am also on a Microsoft self-audit at the moment. My first one in 18 years of being a Microsoft server admin. Now, folks, if you've never heard about that, let me just elaborate on that minute. That is when you start looking at all your software and you're doing an audit to make sure that you've purchased enough licenses to cover whatever you're doing on your network. Very important. As a network guy that came up from NetWare, CALs were no surprise. I find that it becomes more of a hurdle to manage licensing when the situation changes. In my job, the company is growing and this puts a new item to keep track of. I would like to know if this was new to other listeners also. Now, again, that is from Jeff, and he is from the Podnuts Network. But I can tell you what, even Jeff, when I built that show last week, when I put that information together, when I started researching about licensing, a lot of it was new to me. You know, I didn't pull this stuff out of years of knowledge by any means. I put the show together, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk about server licensing and what we need to do as administrators. You know, what people need to do out there and what they need to worry about. Now, do I believe, in my wildest imaginations, that Microsoft's going to send some Microsoft auditor into your business, and let's say you're a doctor's office, which I deal with many of those, and they have, let's say, for instance, yeah, let's give it 6 client computers. They have a server running, small business server. Do I think that Microsoft's going to come in and say, we want to make sure you have enough Microsoft Office licenses? Probably not. But today, you know, the way they do these licenses and the way you have to activate everything, it's really hard. And let me also elaborate to any company out there that's trying to do this, don't download illegal software. Don't use anything. Don't use hacking keys. Don't use anything to get around the activation. If you're running a network, it's part of the business cost, the cost of doing business, or what do they call that? The total cost of ownership, the TCO, to have to buy software. Software is not free. People write software, and it's our job to make sure that it is purchased. So don't ever try to get around that. I think that's just wrong and very, very low, and you should never do that. Now, let me kind of elaborate on this licensing scheme first. It's my understanding from when Windows XP Pro came out and Windows 7 Pro, the Pro versions, that it was said that they come with a client access license to access the server. Now, I guess Microsoft knew that most of us would be connecting these to a server, right? Because it's the professional versions. I never in my lifetime, as far as 27 years of working with this stuff, I never remember a time when one of my clients could not connect to the server because there was not enough client access licenses. Think about that. If you've never added a client access license, did you ever get a message that said, you can't connect because there's not enough licensing available? Now, on the flip side of that, I do remember when we had more than 2 users connecting to an RDP server, that the third user or the first user, if a third user tries to connect, the first you can get kicked off. Because remember, I said that those 2 users are administrative accounts. So you can remote in and you can use your Active Directory. You can work on your DNS, do whatever you want to do. Those are built in and they're free. They've always been that way as long as I can remember. But you need to buy RDP clients if you're going to set up something like an application server, just to elaborate on that, and you're going to have everybody using one server, you got to make sure you have enough licenses to allow multiple connections into that RDP server. It's very important, and they will get a message if they cannot connect. Now, let's go back to Jeff's questions about these printers, the cameras, the routers, and the copiers. Let me try to re-elaborate on this. As we set up all of our printers as IP printers. Now, if you're setting up an IP printer, that means that you will go to your computer, either your Mac or your Windows computer or your Linux box, whatever you're using, and you will set the printer up, and you will tell it it's an IP-based printer. And you put the IP address in there, and you print right from your computer right to the printer. That does not need a client access license because that printer is not controlled by the server. The printers I am talking about is the printers that you're setting up to create a print server. So the server is now managing those printers, and you're setting the users up to give them permissions to print to so-and-so printer. You're loading drivers on there. Then yes, you do, by the writing of Microsoft and by the licensing agreement, you do need a client access license to use that print server with that device, because now that device is on your server as a client device. Because remember, there's two ways to set licensing up, right? There's users and per device. Well, it's a device. Now, such things as I just said, IP printers do not, routers do not, because routers are not controlled by the server. Again, we're talking about server-controlled devices and copiers. So if you have a copier in your office somewhere that you use for, you know, making duplicates or copies of something, you do not. If that copier is, in fact, a multifunction copier, which many of them are nowadays, and you are connecting it again to a print server, then yes, it would need a license for that device. Now, let's flip that. I'm going to give you one that's even more difficult to understand, and we do a lot of this in our business. The copiers can also be set up as a multifunction scanner, where you're scanning back to a shared file folder. At that point, you do not need a client access license, because if you think about it, you're just scanning and you're copying a file, a PDF probably, into a folder on a server. It's not connected to the server in any way. You're just basically making a copy of a file, so you do not. So Jeff, thank you very much for the feedback. I do appreciate it. And hopefully if you get some answers from your volume licensing sales reps, I would love to hear some more responses from you, and I really do appreciate that feedback. Tonight in this show, I'm going to get as far as I possibly can. We're going to be breaking down what's called DNS records. Now, I've done shows in the past on DNS, so don't shell off and say, whoa, Jack, you did this before. You know, you created a DNS show. We talked about DNS. We talked about, you know, dynamic DNS, static DNS, how we get records in the DNS servers. But I never broke down the entirety of the DNS server to tell you what it actually does. Do you know what it does? And when I started doing the research for tonight's show, I thought, wow, I'm going to put this together just so I can throw it out there. And I'm going to try to get through most of this in our allotted time frame. We're going to first start talking about the highest level of the DNS record, and that is called the resource record. The resource record is referred to as RR, and it's the unit of information in DNS zone files. Now, RR is a basic building block of host names and IP information. We use resource records to resolve all DNS queries. Okay, while there are a handful of commonly known RR types, RR comes from a fairly wide variety of flavors in order to provide extended name resolution services. Now, as I mentioned before, the resource records are in the file of or on the DNS server called the zone file. The zone file is basically just a database, which means it has a special way of formatting so that each record is unique and accessible. A record is a unit of information in the database. Let's talk about some of the basic stuff that's in the resource record. Okay, the first one is we're going to talk about the name or the resource record and the naming record. So if we have a website called abc.com, and this is the line that we have in our DNS, abc.com space 600 space in space A space 150.150.150.1. The first field in abc.com, it donates the owner. The second field is 600. This is the TTL perimeter, and that is time to live in the DNS record. The third field in is the class field that represents a protocol family, which is almost always in for internet class. The fourth field, A, is the type of resource that the RR is representing. And then the fifth field is 150.150.150.1 is the resource data or R data. This field is a variable type that provides information appropriate to the type of the resource. In this case, obviously, it's an IP address. Now, the following resource record types are commonly used in DNS. in the start of authority. Now, you've probably seen all this stuff in your DNS, and you're like, what in the world is this? The start of authority is the SOA record. Again, these are all records in our DNS, in our resource record that we see when we're in there, and we never really do much about it. All these records are in the resource record for the SOA. The name server, NS, the pointer record, PTR, the address, which is the A record, the mail exchange record, which is the MX record, very critical, important if you're running mail, right, email servers, the chronicle name, which is CNAME, the Windows Internet Naming Service, which is the WINS, and the WINS reverse, which is the WINS-R, and then the service, which is the SRV, and then load sharing. Now, let's talk about, first of all, about the SOA record. Now, the SOA record is the start of authority record. It is required the first entry in all forward and reversed zone files. Reverse lookups are also available in DNS, which is where you resolve an IP address to a host name using a special domain called in-addr-arpa. The SOA record defines the zone for which the DNS server is authoritative, as well as a specific server that is authoritative for the domain. Now, this is a sample of an SOA record. It starts out with @ space in space SOA, and then you would have abc.com. Next, you will do a serial number of whatever it is. Most people use 3600, or no, serial number of 1. The refresh rate is 1 hour. The refresh rate on your SOA records are created in seconds. So 1 hour is 3,600 seconds. The retry would be 10 minutes, which would be, again, in seconds, 600 seconds. And the expiration of the DNS lookup would be 86,400 seconds, or it would expire in 1 day, with a minimum TTL, or time to live, of 1 hour. So the SOA RR record has the following fields. So I'm going to break this down for you pretty quickly here. The owner is the @ record. It specifies the owner of the record, the DNS server that the zone file resides on. Now, the use of the freestanding @ specifies that the owner, generally the current machine on the server that the file resides on, in the current origin. This is like saying, I own this record. Now, many of you may think that the @ came about for email addresses, and it might have came about for your Twitter handle, but that's not true. The @ originated in DNS, and it kind of got borrowed or taken from DNS for all this great, you know, @ my email address, my domain, @ my name. And now you get it because it's specifying the owner of that name, right? Like, for instance, my Twitter handle, @ Technoman, and that would be my Twitter handle. It's specifying I'm the owner. The class IN specifies the protocol family. In this case, and in most cases, the protocol family is the Internet Protocol family represented by IN. The type SOA indicates that this is an SOA RR. The authoritative server, abc.com, specifies the DNS server that is authoritative for the zone. Now, the authoritative DNS server means that is the key DNS server that's going to replicate to your other DNS servers if you have multiple on your network. The responsible person. So the responsible person would specify the mailbox address of the person, presumably an administrator who is responsible for the zone. Note that this field uses a period instead of an A or the @. So you'd have something like Jack's Tech Corner @ or Jack's Tech Corner period ABC period com instead of JaxTechCorner at abc.com. The serial number 1 specifies the number of times the zone has been updated. When secondary servers contact the primary server to determine whether a zone transfer is necessary, the secondary servers compare their individual serial number with the primary server's serial number. If the primary server's serial number is higher, a zone transfer is necessary. So back up, we've talked about DNS in the past, and we talked about primary and secondary DNS servers. So let's say you go in and you do some static changing in your DNS server. If you do not update, now a lot of times it's updated on its own, so look at it and make sure. But let's say the serial number in your record is number 10. And you save your changes, and if that serial number doesn't change to number 11, your secondary DNS servers will never, ever download the changes. Because if they both match with number 10, then as far as the secondary or the third server or the fourth DNS server are concerned, the authoritative or the primary DNS server has never changed. Because it doesn't see the changes in the record, it's only looking at that serial number. So you would change your serial number to a number 11, and everything else would then automatically pick those up and take those out of there. Let's talk about the refresh number of 3600. Now, if you remember, I told you 3600 is seconds, and it specifies 1 hour, because 3600 seconds is 60 minutes is 1 hour. This is specifying in seconds that the secondary server should wait between checks with the primary server for zone changes. The bracketed notation to its right donates the time in common terms, such as 1 hour. So in other words, you would put in there 3600 semicolon, and then type in refresh, because it's going to refresh that backup domain DNS server, and then in brackets put in there 1 hour. So anybody reading that, they can't convert seconds to hours, they can say, oh, it's 1 hour. They would know that right away. Moving on. The retry number of 600 specifies the time delay, again in seconds, between retries. So what this is saying, it's implying a previous unsuccessful attempt that the secondary server should use when contacting the primary server. Now, what that's telling you there is, if the primary server does not make, the secondary server does not make contact with the primary server, how long should it wait to try again? It should try again 600 seconds. Once that attempt is positive, it downloads the updated information, then it should only check every 1 hour. And folks, these times, if you see a lot of network traffic because you do a lot of DNS changing, which you may or may not do, these times are very much, you can edit these and make these whatever you want it to be. You can make it check less. You can make it check more. It's totally up to you. But the key element here with this podcast tonight is understanding kind of what these records mean, and then you'll have a better idea of what you can do with them to change them. Now, the expired number, 86,400, specifies the time, again in seconds. I don't know which engineer created DNS, but why they did everything in seconds and not pure minutes, I don't know. That the secondary server should wait for a response from the primary service before discarding the copies of the zone file as invalid. So the expire time is 8,400, which is one entire day, 24 hours. And then the minimum TTL, the time to live, the lowest possible time to live, is 3,600 seconds. And that's the default TTL value applied to resource records in the zone that do not specify their own TTL. So even if you don't write a time to live in there, it's going to default to 3,600. Let's look just a minute here or so at the NS resource records. So the name server records describe which servers are secondary servers for the zone specified in the SOA record. and they indicate which servers are primary servers for any delegated zones. The following is an example of an NS resource record. The @ space in space name server, and then give the server name, such as dns1.abc.com. And then you'll add the next one, @ space in space NS space DNS server2.abc.com. And if you have more, you will put them in your name resource records. That way you're actually telling the DNS server what the, you know, the primary server and what any delegated zones out there may be that they should be copying to. Now the owner, the @ specifies the owner of the record as mentioned previously. The use of the freestanding @ specifies that the owner is the current origin. And again, the class N, as specified before, means the internet class. The type NS indicates this is a NS resource record, a name server. So whenever we see NS, we know that that means name servers, right? It's very, very simplistic. The authoritative server, server1.abc.com, is the first record. So you always have the authoritative server first. And then you would have something like dns-server2.abc.com in the second, specifies that the name of the server that houses information about the zone. Pointer records. If you don't have a pointer record, you should probably do this. The pointer record allows for us to have a reverse lookup of our IP addresses. So many times on our network, we try to do a trace route. Let's say you try to do a trace route to a specific server or workstation. And we'll say server because they're pretty much static, right? The workstations could be dynamic, which means they pull their IP address, you know, whenever they turn on or ask the server for one. We're static, we know that we static these, we hard code these numbers into our TCP IP stacks. And we know that those particular servers always have the same IP. But let's say, for instance, if you do a trace route and you do a trace route to server1.abc.com and it comes back unspecified or unknown. If you know the IP address, you can then, if you have your pointer record set up, you can do a trace route to the IP address and you should be able to resolve the server name. Because it's like it's a reverse lookup. That's the idea of the pointer record. The pointer record provides reverse address resolution. Okay. And you set these up very simply. And, you know, so many people miss this. And I have in the past where I don't set them up because most times you're okay without them. And there's sometimes when you do need them. I did find one time I got an email server on a blacklist. My email server was blacklisted. And you know, that happens because if you have, especially when I was running I was running my own internet provider company, I fell into this. And the way we fell into it actually was we had a couple users that paid us a monthly service fee. And you don't monitor the traffic people are doing. But they started spamming, and this was early on with internet. Remember, when I had my internet service company, we were one of the first dial-up organizations pretty much in the States. That's how early on I had this thing going. It was right after CompuServe was shutting down. AOL was starting to become not as popular because everybody wanted the real internet, and I was providing the real internet. So spamming was not as prevalent. Spamming was not as big then as it is today, but it was in fact being done. Well, our email server got on a blacklist, and the reason it got on the blacklist was because we didn't have a reverse lookup for our MX records. So the companies out there that was putting us on the blacklist tried to do a reverse lookup to get to our DNS servers and say, look, is this a real legitimate company? Well, I never set these things up for our MX records. So when they type the IP address in and they try to do a trace route back to my MX, my mail server, they couldn't get there. So they immediately blacklisted our email domain, our whole domain. And if you've ever had that happen to you before, it is horrific. The best way I can tell you to fix it is change the IP address of your mail server. Put that in your MX records and start over. Once your IP address is blacklisted for your email, it is horrific. I mean, I spent hours awake. I mean, I drank pots of coffee trying to stay awake to rebuild my relationship with all these companies, and we could not get off a blacklist. Let me tell you what, it's much easier to get somebody on a blacklist than it is to get them off the blacklist. Once you get on there, it is so hard to get off. It's easier just to change your IP address. But to create a pointer record in your DNS, in your resource records, you put the IP address, period, in-addr-arpa, space in, space PTR for pointer, and then the domain name. So let's say, for instance, it's mail.abc.com. Then anybody doing that reverse lookup on your IP address will in fact come to your mail server and know that you are a legitimate person. Some places we have out there, and I don't know if they do this much anymore, but you'll email them, and if your DNS is not set properly, you don't have a reverse lookup pointer record, they will not accept your emails, because somehow their email, that's how they fight spam. If they can't come back and see your email server with your IP address, they just block your email. That's happened to me in the past also. That's how I know this stuff. Let's see now. The resource record, the address, the A record is the most common. You probably use this in your own network. And if you don't, I hope you learn how to do it. I just had to do this the other day. I went to my DNS server and I had to make an A record for one of our servers. And in there, I would type in there, let's say the server name is Tonka Truck. So I do Tonka Truck space in space A space and then the IP address of the Tonka Truck server. That's all I need. To make sure this works, once you save your DNS record, go out, open a command prompt, type in there trace RT, right? T-R-A-C-E-R-T space, and then type in Tonka Truck. Once you do that, it should automatically come back with the IP address and do one hop to find it, because you're going to trace route it. It will do one hop to find it. And it just is incredibly fast, but sometimes you got to do that. Know your DNS servers. Know how to register at least learn how to create an A record. It is so terribly important. So the first field is the owner or the host of the record. Next comes the class, the record type, and the authoritative server. The standard structure explained earlier, which is, again, the server is Tonka Trucks, then space in, space A for the A record, and then the IP address. MX records we talked about early on, and the MX record is your mail exchange. Now, everybody, no matter who you are, no matter what service you're using for your email, you need to set up MX records. If you own a domain name and you have IP addresses, you need to know how to set up an MX record on your outside DNS server. Remember before I talked about DNS and we talked about inside servers as opposed to outside servers. It's critically important that this is created on your outside server. And I'll tell you why. The main reason why this happens is when somebody goes to email your organization, the internet is going to go out and go to your DNS, wherever you purchased your domain name. It's going to go there and it's going to say, oh, okay, Jack's domain name server is whatever the IP address is, 209.209.209.209. It's going to go to my DNS server, whatever company I use, doesn't really matter. And it's going to say, hey, does Jack have an MX record? And it's going to look for my first MX record, and that's where it's going to ship my email to. So let's say we have our MX records, and you can have as many of these listed. Let's talk about this a second. So the first one is abc.com. We use space in space MX for mail exchange record space. Give it a number, as your priority order. I don't care if this is two. I don't care if you do 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. If you do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's going to look for the lowest number first and say, okay. So the first one is exchange1.abc.com. It's going to go see if it can find your first exchange server. If the exchange server is unavailable for any reason, it's going to go back to your MX record and say, hey, do they have another path for me to take? And again, it's going to say abc.com in space MX record space number 2 or number 4, the next number in that sequence. What it doesn't have to be sequenced numbers, the next higher number. It's going to say exchange server2.abc.com, and it's going to take and send the email there and say, hey, is there any server here? The path is not there. I can't get to that server. It goes back to your MX record. Does he have another mail server? abc.com in space MX space number 5 is exchange. Let's say, I'm just making these names up. exchange server4.abc.com. It goes out through there. It says, oops, I found exchange server 4. It dumps your email into there, and the message is delivered. If it cannot deliver the message, it gets bounced back, and it goes back to the person as an undeliverable message. So, if you think you can create a larger scale mail service than Google Apps, then bless you. Or probably even Microsoft's new Microsoft 360. I haven't played with it, but I understand it's probably as good as Google Apps. I would say it has to be. Google Apps provides me with 12 different separate MX records. So it tells me there's 12 possible servers for my email to go to in 12 different geographical locations that I could never create. My company could not afford me to spend that kind of money to rent server farms, to rent server locations, to provide internet access to those servers to create that. So if you're not using Google Apps or Office 360 with all of its redundant servers out there, then folks, you're going to not sleep well at night. Remember, most things I do with my network and most things I build on my servers, I do so I can sleep well at night. Matter of fact, maybe next week we'll talk about some important stuff like backups, SQL backups, some scripts I had to write to get databases to back up when I want them to back up and know where that data is in case the server crashes, because I'd like to be able to get some sleep. But that is why you want to have multiple MX records and make sure you have a sequence of numbers. So if it can't be delivered, it will bounce to the next one. And some of this other stuff we are not going to get to tonight. No. I do have a link that I'm going to be adding to the show notes tonight. I'm going to put that in the show notes, and I found it on Wikipedia. And what the link is gives you a bunch of different DNS record types. And you can use those types to do multiple things for it. You know, somebody once said, Jack, why do I have to have the authoritative person? Like, why do I want my contact number in my DNS? It's so incredibly important. One time, I'm going to give you my little in the trenches story. One time we had a rogue machine. Now, if you ever had a rogue machine in your network, what this machine was allowing it to do was it had a spyware on it, or maybe a virus or whatever. It was, as we refer to in the tech world, as being hosed, right? We said that machine's hosed. It needs cleaned. So it was sending out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails like every minute. And it was acting as a spam machine, like as a bot almost, if you will, on my network. Well, a company was able to go out there, dig up our DNS records, type in who's the authoritative person on this DNS records, find my name as the administrator. They found my email address as the administrator, and the email said, you have a problem. You need to fix that problem, or they was going to blacklist our domain name so we couldn't send out any more emails in the free world. Well, we did find a problem. I did go to the firewall, and I was able to deny port 25 on all outgoing connections on my firewall. When I did that, it cleared it up, right? I can't send any more emails. And all these little viruses and these bots, they tend to like to use a standard port 25 to send email out of your network. So if you ever get in that trouble, just go to the firewall and block port 25. And what you can do that is if you're not using Exchange server or a mail server in your network, unless you can use a, some other port other than 25. So anyway, what a long show, huh? What a ton of information. And hopefully it didn't seem like I was battling too much. Hopefully we got that out there to you. But understand there's tons of DNS records and be familiar with them and, you know, take control of your DNS server. If you're not managing your DNS server, and you're relying on somebody else to take care of that, folks, you know what? I can almost say, unless it's some server, like some of mine, my personal webpage is like Tips from the Server Room. It's managed by a company, but I don't do anything with that. It's not like I'm the administrator of that company, so I don't need to worry about that stuff. But if you work for a company and you're not managing your DNS and you're trusting this to some other Joe or Jim Bob down the road, you know, rethink your job career changes. You know, make a change. Maybe you want to get into, hairstyling or something. It takes, when you're an administrator on a network, you got to know DNS. It's so incredibly important these days. You can't ignore it. You have to understand what it does. Even if you're just using dynamic DNS and you have a server and you have a computer that's giving you trouble, you need to be able to get that DNS and find that record. You might need to delete it. You might need to change it. So please understand it. Folks, this is something that nobody seems to use, is my Amazon link. Jack, do you have an Amazon link? Well, yes, I do have an Amazon link. Get out of here. I didn't know that. Imagine that. If you go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com, there's a link on there that you can click on when you're going to make any Amazon purchase. But Jack, I'm buying brakes for my car. Would that be okay? Yes. Jack, I'm buying new headphones for my kids. You know, some Dr. Dre's. Would that be okay? Absolutely. Whatever you buy, if you're buying soap detergent, if you're buying car wax, if you're buying dog supplies, flea supplies, pet supplies, whatever, you can use that Amazon link. How do I know that nobody's using it? Because I keep getting these great emails from Amazon. I'm sorry, you did not make the minimum of $100. You will not be receiving any payment. And I've received that ever since I had an Amazon link. So, folks, I am begging, I am asking, I am pleading with you at this point. Please give me one check before the end of the year. You know, I don't even want to be begged for money. I don't really do this to make any money. I just want to see an Amazon check to see what it looks like and say, wow, I got one. But I got to raise $100 in advertising dollars. And it doesn't cost you anything else. You're not going to pay any more money. Just click on that link and buy what you're going to buy. That's all. Okay, folks, and I know there's a lot of you out there just learning Windows servers, and I know you're looking for a great school to take this in, and I know you probably heard of, you know, Jack's Tech Corner and his great online courses and how beneficial those are to you, so why not get on there and sign up today? If you want to learn Windows Server 2008 R2, Windows Server 2012 R2, or VMware ESXi 5.5 from install to administration, from I don't know a damn thing about servers to I am a master of the server race, then you need to take my courses. This is so critically important for you to get in there and take these courses. And yes, are they cheap? Yes, they're not cheap. They're low priced because many server administrators out there, or would-be server administrators, if you just knew what to do, I mean, you may be out of work. I don't want it to be $3,000. If I was going to charge $25,000 or $100,000, that's what they're worth. You can go to college and learn that, right? I wanted to make it so you didn't have to go to college to learn it. You can learn what you need to know and exactly get the feel for it and know exactly what you need to know to go out there and get that job making $70,000, $80,000 a year being a server admin. Just go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Look for the online class link at the top of the page. Click on that and sign up for the online courses today and get started. If you don't get started, you'll never get that job. We can all wish upon a star, and we can all hope that the knowledge comes through our little heads as we're laying in bed in the middle of the night. But folks, knowledge doesn't happen that way. That's not the way you get knowledge. To get knowledge, you have to learn. To learn, you need a teacher. Allow me to be your professor, your instructor in the world of servers, and you'll be on your way to greatness and to making more cash flow than, you know, than what you're making now. So sign up for one of those courses today. Once you finish it, I will mail you in the mail, snail mail, you know, through the mail in a big envelope, a certificate. I don't fold it up. It's beautiful. It's a great certificate, suitable for framing, suitable for copying. People send these with their resumes, and they're getting jobs. I'm getting tons of responses back saying, Jack, you know, I only paid like $300 for your course, and man, I landed that server job. Amazing. Or Jack, I landed that administrator job. I can't thank you enough. And I get these responses all the time. So check those courses out at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Sign up today. Start getting the knowledge in your head. We can all wish upon a star, but we need to learn now. It's important to understand this stuff. With that said, folks, I hope you have a wonderful work week. I mean, it's Tuesday. What else can we got to go wrong now? We got over Monday. We got through Tuesday. We're going to hump day tomorrow, Wednesday, and then it's all downhill from there. And folks, if you're not, if you're sitting at home hoping for that phone to ring for that server administrator job, start taking these courses. You're not doing anything anyway, so sit down, start learning, and all you got to do is watch a video and take a short quiz. So do that when you're sitting there waiting for that phone to ring. Until next Tuesday, folks, have a great work week, and thank you so much for listening. I'm always humbled that you download these shows. We have you know, a few thousand listeners now. Let's make that a few hundred thousand, a few million, and make it even more. Spread the word out there and let other server administrators know that tipsfromtheserverroom.com is hot, ready to go, and ready to listen to each and every week. Take care, my friends. I'll talk to you next week on Tips from the Server Room. Bye for now. You just listened to Tips from the Server Room with your host, Jack. If you have any questions, please drop me a comment at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Thanks again for tuning in and downloading the shows. Now sit back, relax, and listen to the remainder of the music. We'll see you next week on Tips from the Server Room. So long.